Hey, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Prioritizing, a married couple's faith-based insight into what is most important in education, in marriage, and in life. I, as always, am joined by my much better half, Samantha. Good evening, Samantha.
Good evening, Michael.
How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am just peachy. Now, thanks for being here, as always. Now, for those of you tuning in, if you haven't done so already, give us a follow or you can always check us out on iTunes if it's more convenient. Have a listen in the car. Learn from us on our opinions on how to be better teachers. Because we always say we are not the experts, but we do like to share our knowledge and our experiences of the classrooms. But we do today, we have a very special guest for you. We do have an expert in the house, as we're going to be talking about our classroom behaviors that we've seen in the past. My much, much older sister Colleen jump in. She is a, what are you, Colleen? Hey, Colleen, by the way. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Our pleasure.
I'm a board certified behavior analyst. That's my title.
So, Colleen, that's a lot of words with a lot of important letters behind it, I'm sure. An acronym goes with that. What is it? A BCABA?
BCBA, Michael.
BCBA. What's a BCABA?
That is an assistant or associate BCBA.
Assistant to the behavior analyst.
Assistant to the behavior analyst.
So you're a BCBA. Very good. Now, what does a BCBA do? Like, what is your job? What do you do with your kids?
Well, I come in when inappropriate behaviors are too hard for the teachers or parents to handle, and I decrease the behaviors. Or I'll come in and build skill deficits so the child can see.
So you're essentially teaching the parents how to reinforce positive behavior in their homes or teachers in the classroom and kind of giving the kids new skills to replace the poor behavior?
Yes, Michael.
Yes, okay. So, Kyle, what Samantha and I will do is we will kick you some scenarios that have happened in our classrooms and some other hypothetical scenarios, and we'll kind of get your expert opinion on how to handle, on what's the best way to go about handling that child. Does that sound fair?
Yes, sounds great.
Okay.
Sounds great.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, so Samantha, why don't you kick us off? I know you have a big one. You're ready to kick at her.
Well, one situation that's standing out to me is during my first year teaching, I had a young man who was struggling very much with behavior, and he had a lot going on in his life, and different situations were changing. He had a lot of new scenarios that he was encountered with daily, but what really came down to the struggle in our classroom was that he was very impulsive in his reactions, and very little things would set him off. So whether it be the tapping of a pencil or someone looking at him the wrong way, it would lead to a giant outburst. Screaming, shouting, he would chew on his sleeve, so much so that when he took it out of his mouth, it would be wet all the way up to the elbow of the sleeve. And then it got to the point where it got violent, and he had reacted and punched a classmate in the stomach just because he felt so trapped and like he had no other option. So, Colleen, at that time, I know for me it was really tough starting out and working with the school therapist and with other teachers on how to best document these behaviors and support the kid, but I had no tools in my toolbox, as you could say. I had never encountered a behavior like this. So for a teacher starting out, or for a teacher who maybe has been teaching for a few years, how would you suggest handling this behavior?
All right, well, that's a great question. I get that a lot, actually, when teachers call me in to consult in schools. You mentioned a bunch of different behaviors, so what I would do when I come in is to talk about specifically each individual behavior. So what did chewing on the shirt look like? When did it happen most during the day?
It would happen pretty much any time there was a stressor in the situation that would cause this child to be anxious, whether it be a subject that he was struggling with at the time, or even in an assembly where he was trying to sit still and control his behaviors, that he would channel that into the chewing. And we eventually got like a necklace that has the rubber piece on the end that he could chew on to avoid the sleeve, but it redirected the behavior to a smaller scale, but it was still there.
Can I cover the four functions of behavior right now?
Yeah, go right into it. What are the four functions, first of all, Colleen?
So, the four functions of behavior are positive reinforcement. So the child either wants attention from either a peer or a teacher, or the child wants positive reinforcement as far as a tangible, so some reward or item they're getting for doing the behavior. So those are the first two. The third is escape. So the child is trying to get away or avoid something aversive to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth is sensory. So they do it throughout the day. There's no real trigger. So sensory behavior. That's what it sounds like shirt chewing is, based on just the short amount of information you've given me. So other things besides providing an incompatible, like a chewy, we would do something called a DRO. We would reward him for absence of the behavior. So I might sit with him at an assembly, and every minute he goes without chewing, he would get a reward, and we would gradually build that up so he can sit throughout the whole assembly without engaging in the behavior.
Now, Colleen, to jump in for a minute, mm-hmm. Would you continue that to the next assembly, or would that just be a one-time thing, or how long would that reward system continue?
Typically throughout the school year, so I take data on everything I do. So all my interventions, I'll take data before I start an intervention so I can see how often the behavior is happening. So out of 20 intervals during an assembly, he chews a shirt 19 of them. I'll take that data, and so I'll kind of get a feel for what the behavior looks like and how often it occurs, and then I'll take data on once I start the intervention. So if we want him chewing minimally throughout the day, then once that behavior gets low enough and we maintain that, I would leave, or the teacher would remove the intervention. So it's based on the child's performance.
Sure. Clearly, I mean, you don't have access to the student's records, or haven't taken any data on the student, so you can't answer specifically what could be the cause of these. So let me just ask, and so our listeners can understand, are you able to diagnose students with what they may have?
No. So I just look at the behavior. I don't go by diagnosis, so it doesn't matter if they have ADHD or autism, or it doesn't matter. I just come in and look at what they're doing.
And the why behind it?
Yep, and the function behind it, and I focus on the function. I do function-based interventions.
Is the function essentially the why? Like, is that?
Yep, the reason why.
Terms? Okay.
Yes, the reason why the behavior occurs. So there's only four: to get something or to get away from something.
I see.
Or because it feels good. That's the sensory.
Okay.
Another behavior you were talking about, Samantha, is tapping a pencil. That was sensory-based. To determine if it was sensory, I would come in and look at the child and see what happens right before the behavior and what happens right after the behavior. So if I came in and I saw you were giving a worksheet and then he started tapping, if I saw a pattern of what happens right before the behavior or a pattern of what happens right after the behavior, it gives me a sense of what the function might be. If it is sensory, which it might be if he taps throughout the day, or for no reason at all, we would do the same type of intervention. It doesn't matter what the behavior is. It's based on the function. So we would do an incompatible or praise him for lengths of time without engaging. So maybe we would have him put his hands in his pockets when he's walking in the hall, or praise him when he has his hands on his desk or using the pencil correctly. So that's what we would do for sensory-based behaviors, not the behavior itself, but the function.
Right. Now, I see you brought up something that I was thinking about earlier. What happens right before the function, right before the behavior, and right after the behavior? Now, clearly you're taking data, and how long would you say you have to observe a child before you are able to narrow in on what it actually could be, on average?
I come in, I interview the teachers and the parents who know the children best, and I will do a full day observation, and that'll give me enough information. It depends on how often they do the behavior. If it's punching and it only happens once a week, I might have you take, we call it ABC data on what happened right before the antecedent, the actual behavior and the consequence, ABC. So I would have the teacher take data if it was infrequent, but if it was a behavior that happened frequently, like off task, something like that, I could probably get a good feel for just a day or two observation,
mm-hmm.
and be able to, after the interviews, be able to give you some strategies based on the function, not behavior.
Right. Now, Samantha, you said you had another behavior you wanted to jump into?
Yes. I was actually thinking a little bit about what Colleen was saying for the ABC chart, and I read this great book called The Behavior Code, which focuses on the reasons behind different behaviors, and it was really insightful to how to keep track and handle those behaviors. But for me, part of what's so challenging as a classroom teacher is when I have those behaviors happening consistently throughout the day, almost like every few minutes, how to record that myself while I'm still supposed to be teaching and still helping the needs of the other 20 students in my class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so hopefully you have some kind of support. I know a lot of people have school psychologists or things like that who oversee, but videotaping is a really easy way, and you can always go back and look at it later. Some teachers use that in their classrooms.
Now, of course, for all you newer teachers out there, you'd always have to get some kind of sign-off from or parent permission. Most schools will do that, but some schools that don't do it from the administrative level, you'd have to do it from the classroom level as well, just so the parents know what's happening, because they'll want to know why that's happening at all. To a parent, hearing for the first time that their child's going to be recorded in class might sound a little fishy. So make sure you're open. That goes back to the parent communication piece that we talked about a couple of podcasts ago. Now, if I could, I'd like to share with you, this is more of a hypothetical slash real experience. I kind of twisted some details, Colleen, if you don't mind. Imagine a student new to the school, so I'm throwing that perspective at you so you can kind of get a background on the social aspect of it. New to the school, seemed, let's just say, more aggressive behavior, but respectful to the face of the teacher. Behaviors behind the back or at recess or during specials are much more vindictive and sneaky. As the year progressed, it's fair to say that the student's behavior was stagnant. It wasn't surprising to us that these things were happening. We were almost used to it, and we knew how to handle it in the classroom, so he wasn't sent to the office or anything like that. There were certain occasions when the student would, for example, I remember teaching a lesson, and when I'm in the middle of my small group instruction, he fake yawns and does a over his mouth right at me. And I laugh now because it's funny to reflect back on it, but I can remember that feeling as a new teacher and just feeling my blood boil to see such a youngster able to do that, and he's blatantly trying to disrespect. And it was, that part was new because I hadn't seen that before, and I felt as though we were past those kind of behaviors. But then all of a sudden later in the year he throws that one out there. So there's a lot to take in, and knowing the student, I know you don't have the history, and teachers don't share that history with random people, of course. From the basis of what I shared with you, the very slim details, is there anything you can give me some insight as to what the cause was or why or what was driving the behaviors, maybe?
Well, I have a question. I besides yawning, can you operationalize that better? Can you define it? So what did it look like?
Well, he wasn't disrespectful to the teachers. He was respectful. You'd speak to him. But I noticed he had behaviors on the playground, whether he was being rough with a friend or pinching or pushing or spitting even. I'd speak to him one-on-one after the fact, privately, and not in front of his peers. And he would say, "Yes, Mr. Pryor. No, Mr. Pryor. Okay, I understand." At first, it was, "Okay, great. This won't happen again." But then, of course, you see the pattern continues, and that's just lip service by that point. Disrespect to his peers was usually, if he sat next to a student, he would, if a student was on the edge or struggling during an assignment and he saw that they were struggling, he might whisper in their ear something to kind of make them a little more agitated. He knew how to push people's buttons, I should say. Operationalize, is that the term you use? Now, what does that mean exactly?
It just means to put it into words that are observable and measurable so I can come in and know what the behavior looks like before I get there. So disrespecting peers is hard.
Yeah, it's vague. I understand.
But if you say he's pushing peers out, now I can visualize that. Now I know what to look for.
Sure. So he's antagonizing in physical and verbal ways, I should say.
Verbal and physical inappropriate interactions with peers.
Yeah.
I have two things I want to say. So what I would do is, I would look at what happens right before the behavior and what happens right after the behavior. So if I found a pattern, for instance, every time most of the time he is rough with a friend and he gets a peer reaction, so he gets peer attention for that, we might put strategies in place where he's getting peer attention appropriately. Mm-hmm. So he might be the class helper or something like that, where we can set up ways, if he needs peer attention, we can give it to him in appropriate ways before the behavior even happens. But also, I might have more supervision on the playground, more reward systems in place. So if he had a recess without those behaviors, he would earn something. Or
sure.
Especially if it's a group thing that he can earn, like a pizza party for his peers, so he's getting that peer attention.
So he's
built
the hero,
in.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different things, but it would be based on what's occurring in the environment. So what's happening right before, what's happening right after the behavior. But it sounds like if it was peer attention, then we would focus on how we can give him that peer attention in different ways, mm-hmm. and how we can eliminate. So if we could talk to the peers and say, if he does this behavior, ignore it. That's really hard to control with peers, but if you can get buy-in from the classmates so he's not getting reinforced anymore by yeah. doing those things.
And I would imagine that would be easier, and Samantha, maybe you can weigh in on this, that would be easier to accomplish at an older grade level just because younger students in nature are just a bit more compulsive. So they can they aren't as able, if someone says something that bothers them, they're not able to say, okay, Mr. Pryor has asked us not to react. They can't process that quickly. They hear something mean, they respond.
Yeah, I agree, Michael. And that was actually my next question for Colleen was how, as a behavior analyst, what role do you have with the other students in the class? And do you work with them at all on how to handle or react to those behaviors? Because teaching fifth grade, you definitely had situations where the students have years of more practice with how to handle social situations and how to handle frustrations in the best social setting. So whether that be ignoring it, taking a break, going for a walk, getting a drink of water, or writing it down, they have some of those coping skills already to ignore the behavior. But it's still a weak area for many students, and sometimes adults as well, on how to not react to something that you feel in your core is going to make you burst.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there's a lot of stigma, too, when you think about getting other people involved. If you're working with one person's behavior, you can't control how other people react. Yeah, so typical interventions will have something that happens. We'll put in an intervention to work with a trigger of the behavior, what happens right before the behavior. We'll also teach an alternate skill to the child, and we'll control or put interventions for what happens after a behavior. So if it's like peer attention, we would give him peer attention before the behavior happens. We would teach him appropriate ways to ask for peer attention. So, hey, can we play ball together? Or, hey, you want to wrestle? So they can play rough appropriately. But as far as the function of peer attention, it's very hard after the behavior to have any control over what his peers do. So other than teaching them as a group to ignore or tell the teacher, we would really have interventions in place that were hopefully strong enough where they would still be effective even though we don't have control over other people's behavior. So a good reward system, enough incentive in place before the behavior, giving him classroom chores that help him build his social skills and help his peers appropriately, yeah. and hopefully that'll be strong enough.
And positively, too. Yes. Now, you mentioned, one thing I want to point out is that Colleen just touched on something that Samantha and I have been talking about since our first podcast, and that's when you're dealing with a behavioral issue in the classroom, you don't want to single out a student or single out the behavior that it's obvious to the rest of the class what you're talking about. A lot of teachers, I can remember growing up, you know, you'd single out a very specific behavior. If you're talking to the whole class about punching people and there's only one kid who punches people, it's very obvious to the students who you're talking about. And then, you know, the kid who you're singling out, you know, he's smart. He knows what you're doing. He's smart enough to catch on. There's a way to go about it, and it's not by stigmatizing. It's talking to the whole group. It's having the counselor come in and read a book to the class about how to be a good friend and doing small group activities. And as Colleen mentioned, you know, giving incentives for the child to behave, because if there's no reason for them to behave, what good is it? So I like the idea of putting students to work with classroom jobs, making them feel special in a positive way, and like they're the leader of the group, and they can do things in a positive light. Samantha, you were going to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted Colleen to elaborate a little bit more. For people who aren't as familiar with the incentives or how to deal with behaviors, the incentives are short-term, correct? So gradually they'll be removed as the support of that behavior is not needed as much. Is that correct? So it's not like you're replacing the behavior with all these incentives. And then, you know, someone who's not as familiar might question, well, what happens when the incentives aren't there in a different situation? Am I correct in saying that the main purpose is to provide that student with skills over time that they don't need the incentives in a unexpected situation?
Yes, absolutely. So anytime a teacher gives a reward to a child, they should pair it with praise. So the child gets used to hearing, great job for staying in your seat, great job for whatever they're doing right, so they can repeat it. Eventually, the goal is to fade the reward, so just verbal praise is enough to keep the child motivated. And because we're focusing on changing the environment to prevent triggers, and you're also teaching that replacement skill, so if they're trying to get out of a worksheet by hitting, we're teaching them how to ask for a break appropriately. The idea is to fade the reinforcement over time because they've been hearing you say, great job for what they did right. It's behavior-specific praise. You're telling them exactly what they did right so they can repeat it. Teaching break and teaching them these skills will intrinsically be motivating, and we're fading the extra the reward. So they're able to behave similar to their peers with just simple praise, and the skills we taught them are intrinsically motivating.
Right.
So we do fade that over time.
Well, and the thing that stood out to me, Colleen, that Michael and I have talked about a bunch is that the comments that a teacher or a parent should be saying to their to that child needs to be specific, not just the good job, but as you had mentioned, adding the four and it, having them feel that pride and that success with the reason behind it. Because sometimes good job, oh, well, good job for what? You know, the behavior isn't incredibly clear.
Meaningful feedback is what, you know, even on little homeworks, I mean, of course, you give a math worksheet, they do 10 problems, you can say great job or nice work, that's fine. But I mean, if you give a project saying great job, you know, you want to single it out. I like the way you did this, or I can see you really put forth your best effort here or there. So you're giving very, very specific feedback so the child can actually take something away from it. It's not just, hey, good job.
And it puts the responsibility and ownership back on the student. There's this book called Choice Words by Peter Johnston, which is a great, it's a very short read, thin book, but it's all about the language that you are using in the classroom and how to become aware and change your language to center it on the students.
All right. Now, I hate to spoil the fun here, folks, but you know, we're getting close to that 30-minute threshold, and you know, we promise we'd try to keep it under 30. But Colleen, before we conclude, I want to kind of see if you had any closing remarks or things to tie up, any loose ends that we missed that you just kind of want to add, or any just insight from your profession that you want to share.
Yes, I just wanted to summarize. So I want you all, teachers and parents and significant others, anyone who has relationships with human beings, to think about what happens right before the behavior and what happens right after the behavior. So think about if the behavior, if he's trying to get out of a work demand, let's say, and he's hitting or cursing to get out of work, he doesn't want to do the work, think about what you could do before the behavior to prevent it. So how can you make that situation less aversive to him? Maybe give him half a worksheet. Think about what skill you can teach to replace that behavior. So if he's kicking to get out of work, what can you teach him in order to
you can
get out of work appropriately?
To build off what Colleen's saying, when I taught first grade, I'd use a first then chart. I'd have something on their desks, and they'd have something to look forward to. I'd say first math, then recess. Like, so they at least they know they're on math. It's not fun. They don't like it, but they know they have recess coming right up, so it's a visual aid for them, and they know they have something to look forward to. Matthew, you look eager to jump in. Go ahead.
Oh, and, well, we are talking about examples of ways you can do that for kids who need to move all the time, and who, when the behaviors happen, when they're stuck in a spot for too long, have them deliver the library books to the library, or even just bring an envelope to the main office before you need them to sit down for 20 minutes.
Right.
Or go get a drink of water. And if you introduce those behaviors in the right way and slowly, I had a student one year, a couple of years actually, where we set it up that they were able to eventually recognize when they needed a break. And we had a signal, and they'd walk out into the hall and just sit down for a few minutes or walk to the water fountain. And after 3 or 4 minutes, they were right back in their seat, but it happened before the behavior exploded.
Right.
Great. Yes, that's a huge point, Samantha. Thank you. It's very important, once the behavior occurs, to not give the child what they want after the behavior. So it's very important before the behavior occurs, yes, give them scheduled breaks modify the worksheet so it's less aversive to them. Maybe have it, if you're working with younger kiddos and they love cars, have the math worksheet with cars on it, something that's preferred to them, so it's a little bit more motivating for them to actually engage in the demand. Teach them how to ask for a break appropriately. So before those precursors, let them know you can ask for a break if you need one. But after the behavior, you cannot give them a break anymore. You can't send them to the office to move. Once the behavior happens, you don't want to reward them for communicating inappropriately. So you would just keep on with the demand or with whatever you were asking of the child.
Sure. I hate to – this could be one of those podcasts that could go on and on because you know, we've only scratched the surface here. We've only given, I think, three scenarios of behaviors in the classroom, and I'm sure some teachers are thinking of 20 more out there, and we apologize for not getting to every single one of them. So we apologize for not getting to all of them. But if you have questions, I know a few of you have done so already, you can leave them on our website, prioritizing.podomatic.com. Or you can also check us out on iTunes and leave us a comment there. Or if you know me personally, you can look me up on Facebook or Twitter and leave me a comment there. Or some of you have sent private messages and asked questions, and we've covered, for the most part, all of your concerns so far. But, you know, we encourage those. And, you know what, it makes it a lot more fun, and it gives us more things to talk about when we're more motivated to get this out on time. Because right now it's Thursday night, and we're pushing the envelope here. But from Samantha and I, Colleen, we'd like to say thank you for coming. And you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
So, Samantha, the one thing we didn't do, and I'm sure you're just devastated because of it, is we didn't recap the last episode.
Bummer.
last week we talked about marriage roles and what they look like for our marriage. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that's what it's going to look like for your marriage, but we shared our insight on why the more traditional route has worked out for us. Is that right, Samantha?
Yeah, and just that traditional doesn't always need to have the negative connotation to it.
Yes, and I think that's what you see a lot of these memes online, and it's the woman in the apron cooking, and it's how, you know, they've come so far. Now, that is true, but I'd say in a lot of ways it's frowned upon when a man being handy or a woman being a great cook or good in the kitchen is a great thing. I think it's something to be welcome. It's also great if a man can learn how to do that. I will say, I didn't mention this last week, but I am awful at cooking.
Unless it's frozen pizzas.
Yeah, I'm really good at those. I'm a cleaner, though. I'm very clean and tidy. I like to clean the house. No aprons for me, though. That's what makes our marriage work well. Whatever works for you is great, but we wanted to share that just so you can see it in a positive light, because it really is. It's worked out for us, and if it works out for you, too, terrific. It is that time, folks. We're sorry for keeping you so long, but thank you so much for tuning in. As always, if you haven't done so already, check us out online or check us out on iTunes. That's prioritizing, because our last name is Prior. For those of you that haven't caught on to that yet, that is all we have for you today. Samantha, any closing words?
None for me.
None for her. None for me, folks. Tune in next week. God bless you.